did well he walk, but all the lang syne, but all the lang syne, my Joe, but all the lang syne, we'll tak a cup o' kindness yet, for all the lang syne, for all the lang syne, my Joe, for all the lang syne, we'll tak a cup o' kindness yet, for all the lang syne.
Auld Lang Syne, sung for us there by Mr. Rob Patterson from an album called Rod Patterson Sings Burns, Songs from the Bottom Drawer. Came out on Green Tracks back in 1996. We have a special guest with us for the last little while, Frank Shaw, who is a big fan and collector of Burns material. I understand you have some reflections on Auld Lang Syne to share with us.
Yeah, Auld Lang Syne. I always like to ask, what comes to mind when you sing it? What language is it in? Because we sing it at least once a year at New Year's, or if you're Scottish, you sing it more. Most are so familiar with the song, but do you know what it really means? One writer said, wouldn't it be interesting if we found out, wouldn't it be funny if we found out it meant eat more Brussels sprouts? But at the same time, you can look at the name, Auld Lang Syne, old meaning old, lang, L-A-N-G, meaning long, syne, S-Y-N-E, is sense. And syne is pronounced like our sign, so keep that in mind. You can interpret this as time's gone by, or as long, long ago, old days gone by, times long past, the good old days. We'll drink a cup of kindness for times gone by, and you can insert either one of these into that. I like Bruce Springsteen's Glory Days, where he meets one of his old high school buddies coming out of a bar. They turn around and go back in and have a few more brewskis, and then they start talking about the good old days. And I have a card I want to read just briefly, John, if you don't mind. This is from an old high school mate of mine that I bumped into at our 50th high school reunion this past year. And we played basketball on the basketball team together. And he said, Frank, I hope this Christmas card finds you and your family well. When I saw you at our class reunion, it brought back so many good memories, memories that I will cherish for the rest of my life. Let's get together and reminisce about the good old days. And that, my friend, is Auld Lang Syne. But do not think that this is a new thing with Burns, because it was used 100 years before Burns by people like Robert Atton and also Alan Ramsey and James Watson. But the one I love most of all was a guy named Matthew Fitt. And he wrote it in this regard: in the days of Auld Lang Syne, as the equivalent Once Upon a Time. So there we go. You have a little bit on Auld Lang Syne. My favorite story is from Carl Sandburg. He's writing in the Lincoln Collector about two men collecting books. True story. Oliver Barrett, the great book collector. Charles Gunther, the manufacturing book collector. This is not only a story about Burns, but a classic portrait in miniature of a true book collector. Barrett saw a manuscript in the handwritings of Robert Burns. The verse happened to be Auld Lang Syne. Barrett said, I want this, Auld Lang Syne. And Gunther says, I know how you feel. I went over to England and I got it, and I had to pay a lot of money. Barrett replies, I want it now. You know how it feels to have it? I don't know how it feels to have it. Gunther says, I will sell you this Auld Lang Syne, and you write out a receipt that any time I want it back, I can buy it back at the same price. So Barrett bought the book, took it home, having signed the receipt. Only 1 week later, he gets a phone call from Gunther. Gunther says, bring back the Auld Lang Syne. You know, I haven't been able to sleep. I hear the waves of Lake Michigan pounding at night, and I think about it. I walk down Michigan Avenue thinking about it. Now it's gone, and I'm not going to live too long. Let me have it back. Now, that's an illustration of two men who had the money to buy the original, mm-hmm. or a copy of the original. Auld Lang Syne, who made it popular? The old man who told Robert Burns about it? Robert Burns himself? Sure, we wouldn't have it if it were not for Burns. But if I may be so bold, I'm going to suggest a Canadian. New York City, 1929, Roosevelt Hotel. A tradition was born. It moved over to the Waldorf some years later. New Year's Eve. After that night, it was played every New Year's Eve for nearly 50 years. It was played first on the radio and then on television. By whom? Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians. Life magazine said, if Lombardi failed to play Auld Lang Syne, the American public would not believe the New Year had arrived. I think it's an interesting note that Lombardi heard it first in his hometown of London, Ontario, sung by the Scottish immigrants.
Hmm. Amazing. So Burns, of course, you mentioned earlier the internationalist aspect of him, but he was also a radical, was he not?
Burns was a radical. He wanted to be independent, and his station in life hampered a lot of that radicalness or a lot of his independence, because no matter what he did, he was relying on someone to pay him. Had he been a man of independent means, chances are we could have seen even more so from Burns. But something that I would recommend people to check out today is a new book by Professor Robert Crawford at St. Andrews, and going through some old stacks in the library at St. Andrews, Crawford came across a manuscript written by a Hebridean, a guy named James MacDonald. I mean, who else from the Hebrides but a MacDonald? It was a recording of a conversation between Robert Burns and a friend in a pub. And this is what MacDonald wrote. They were both staunch Republicans. Both espoused radical democratic ideas. This was a very dangerous conversation. Now, keep in mind that this was in the latter part of the 18th century. You did not speak against the king then, no more than you threatened the president of the United States today. King George would either send you to a penal colony or have your head cut off. Some thought Burns favored an invasion from France, so to prove that he was on England's side, he joined the volunteers in Dumfries. France was going through, you know, that little melee that both Louis XVI and his wife Marie Antoinette lost their heads. You remember Marie, I'm sure, she of the let them eat cake retort. Burns had flirted with dangerous views before, but MacDonald was the last man to have a substantial conversation with Burns, and he wrote it down. And we're lucky today that Professor Crawford found this, and it's in his new book called The Bard. And if I may be so bold, having read only 100 pages of his book, let me go on record right now as saying that I believe that Professor Robert Crawford's book, The Bard, a biography of Robert Burns, will become the definitive biography of Robert Burns in due time. But back then, keep in mind that democracy was a dirty word, very similar to a word that we use today called terrorism. But two brief examples of how Burns would do things. When we sing, "Oh, Save the King," we'll no forget the people. And then another time, when asked to drink to the health of William Pitt, he replied, "I will give you a better toast, George Washington." So yes, there was a radical side to him. I do not believe it was as strong as some do, but you cannot overlook that it was there.
It's interesting that you mentioned the alluded there to the influence on American politics in both directions, in fact, because this week we're about to celebrate the 200th birthday of Abe Lincoln, and I believe he was also a fan of Robert Burns.
He was, and in fact he was asked to give a toast at a Burns dinner, and I may stand corrected here, either in New York or in Washington, and he refused to do so because he said there was nothing he could add to what had already been said about Burns.
Well, we really appreciate you coming down and sharing your love of Burns and your expertise with us and telling us about some of the amazing books you've picked up over the years. In conclusion, is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? Any kind of closing comment on Robert Burns?
John, I want you to know that I'm honored to be here. I appreciate it. But I want you to know further that I had a friend recently who went to Scotland. For some reason, he took his wife. It was money not well spent. She detested Burns for being a hard drinker and a womanizer. And let me state that these things are important and they need to be discussed, but they can blur your mind or they can deflect your mind away, your attention away from the more appealing things about Burns. Politicians talk of one-issue voters. Anyone who thinks of only the bad about Burns is a one-issue person when it comes to him. They don't see the whole picture. So if you look at Burns, the total Burns, all I can say is that I will not and I cannot shy away from the facts of Burns' life, but neither will I make more of that than the facts reveal. You remember the little girl in North Carolina? She heard, she saw. You can be like her and be dead wrong. We've mixed a little bit of the old with the modern today, and I confess, Burns, my Burns, had clay feet. He was a human. He made many mistakes, and I'm glad he acknowledged them. And 250 years later, he stands tall. He has become the national symbol for all things Scottish. He is a Scottish icon. He is a flawed man, to be sure, just like me, just like you. He remains relevant, for at the core of his writing is one word that stands out, humanity. And in closing, I'll say one thing and remind us all of the old Mexican tradition that held that you die three times. The first time is when you cease to breathe. The second time is when you are buried. And the third time is when your name is never spoken or mentioned again. So you're still alive, as far as this tradition goes, as long as your name is spoken or talked about on earth. With over 5,000 books on or about Robert Burns in the Mitchell Library in Glasgow and at the University of South Carolina Library under the G. Ross Roy Collection,